Mississippi's history whispers through shadows and time. From pre-war mansions, where footsteps still echo long after midnight, to forgotten cemeteries, where the air feels heavy with memories. There is a lot to discuss about this haunted state. The grounds have been soaked with blood. The cities chatter with chilling ghost tales. And it's even said that there are enigmatic creatures lingering beneath the Spanish moss and river mist. So for today's episode, we will be talking all about the haunting and horrifying history around the state of Mississippi. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast. As always, I am your host, Kadra. If you're new to the show, hello and welcome. I tell tales every single week that have perplexed me. So if you love a good mystery that leaves you wanting more, don't worry, you're in the right place. And if you end up enjoying today's episode, I would love if you continue to follow along. If you are a returning listener, hello, my friends, welcome back. I'm happy you're here. I have a lot to discuss with you guys today about Mississippi. I want to thank Amanda for requesting this. It seems like you guys like when I talk about your haunted home states and cities. We've done Fort Concho now. I had someone who wanted me to do their haunted cemetery in New York. And I've had a couple other people request things like this that I'm going to do later on. But thank you, Amanda. You guys can always send topic requests to perplexitymysterypodcast@gmail.com. I also would like to welcome my newest patron. Welcome to the Perplexed Society, B. And also thank you to Chelsea and Arthur for editing up your pledges on Patreon. I hope you enjoy all that bonus content. If that interests you guys, there is always tons going on over on Patreon. That's patreon.com/perplexitymysterypodcast. I just released a new creepypasta and a Texas Urban Legends. There's always documentary coverage and lots of bonus things coming out. So you can always go check that out if that interests you. And I'm running a special this month for Patreon as well. Trigger warning for today's episode. Today's episode is going to contain a lot of disturbing content. I will give some specific trigger warnings when we get into the story of the horrific murder of a 17-year-old black boy, LQ Ivy. So listener discretion and all the sources used for today's episode will be available down in the show notes. So without further ado, let's get into today's Haunted Mississippi episode. So there's a lot that we could talk about when we are covering an entire state. I just picked some stories that stood out to me. We won't be discussing the Pascagoula incident in this episode. That is a very famous alien abduction case, and I do plan to cover that at some point. That would take up a whole episode, but we will discuss plenty of other creepy and haunting things that have happened in Mississippi. So let's first discuss a little bit of the history about the state of Mississippi. This, of course, begins with indigenous tribes, primarily Choctaw and Chickasaw tribes. Then there was initial colonization of the region that was carried out by the French. European and American settlers didn't go into this area in a big number until the early 19th century. Rich American settlers brought a lot of enslaved Africans to work on cotton plantations. On December 10, 1817, Mississippi became a state of the United States. And through the 1830s, the federal government bought out most of the native Choctaw and Chickasaw tribes west of the Mississippi River. Mississippi seceded in 1861 and joined the Confederate States of America. Many would go on to fight in the incredibly bloody Civil War. The Union Army had full control by 1865 and slavery was abolished. Mississippi then entered the Reconstruction era, and Democrats regained control of the state in 1875. In 1890, they passed a disfranchising constitution, resulting in the exclusion of African Americans from political life until the mid-60s. With Jim Crow, black people lost all political power and social status, and by 1900, African Americans in the state were typically farm laborers or landless sharecroppers or tenant farmers. Such was the case for the Ivy family. This is the story of LQ Ivy. LQ Ivy, a young black boy, was born in 1907 to Jim Ivy and Allie Peegs, both of whose parents had been slaves. The Ivies were a farming family and they worked incredibly hard. Jim Ivy was a very successful man, which was rare for black men during this time period in Mississippi. By 1920, he owned his first car, a symbol of progress that many white families couldn't even afford. And when LQ was just 17 years old, he would be lynched. Trigger warning, as we go through this story, this might not be something that you're able to listen to. I think it's an important story to tell, but it's incredibly horrific. It's a disgusting crime. LQ was described as a very kind, respectful person. He was always willing to help others. He had a good sense of humor, and he was known for his generosity. On September 18th, 1925, LQ went off to work as usual. He cut timber in Union County. The work was grueling, and the Mississippi heat was unforgiving. But doing the work with his coworkers made things a little bit more tolerable. Cutting timber that day was LQ, along with Spencer Ivy, Cleveland Jones, and Shrill Kilpatrick. The men worked hard for hours, and then at midday, they took a break and had some water. Meanwhile, a 22-year-old white woman named Bessie Gaines would claim that she had been attacked while she was picking peas in a field near her house. She was taken to Mays Hospital for treatment, and Sheriff John W. Roberts was contacted. The sheriff then assembled a group of men and bloodhounds to track down who was responsible. And wouldn't you know, the dogs led the mob, the group, right to LQ Ivy and his other black co-workers. They were resting at a well. LQ was wrongfully accused and taken into custody, then transported to the courthouse in New Albany. And word of his arrest would spread quickly. A mob of over 300 white men gathered outside the courthouse, demanding LQ be turned over to them. Authorities then moved LQ to Aberdeen, but the mob would not let up. A group of men from Etta obtained a formal written order from Judge Thomas Pegram ordering Sheriff Roberts to bring LQ to them immediately. They claimed that Bessie, the girl who was allegedly attacked, needed to see LQ in order to ID him. They claimed she was in really bad shape and might not survive, so LQ had to come with them right now. But instead, Sheriff Roberts didn't listen, and he took LQ directly to the hospital for Bessie's identification. He wasn't letting LQ out of his sight. He knew he was in danger. In the hospital room, Bessie looked at LQ, hesitated, and then uncertainly stated, "I think I would say it was him." Even her father expressed doubts, but it didn't matter. Sheriff Roberts attempted to sneak LQ out of town while others distracted the crowd. A mob of white men chased them down in their car. At the Myrtle Bridge, the sheriff's car was surrounded by more than 1,000 white men. There was no escape. Without resistance, the sheriff handed over 17-year-old LQ Ivy to the mob. The mob then took LQ to a barn near the scene of the alleged attack. LQ was beaten, and then the men hung him from a rafter and proceeded to torture him. They mutilated his body with a blowtorch, they crushed his testicles with a lemon squeezer, and they demanded that LQ confess. But LQ, obviously, had nothing to confess. The mob then drove LQ to an open clearing, and he was forced to stand on a mound of sawdust as a metal stake was driven into the ground. They then tied him to the stake and took a photograph, capturing their crime as if it were a celebration. This photo is available in the sources. I'm not going to post it for obvious reasons. LQ handed his father's car keys to one of the men, asking him to return them. LQ's final words were, quote, "I didn't do it." Then the men set 17-year-old LQ Ivy on fire. No one was ever held accountable for this horrific act, and Sheriff Roberts claimed he couldn't identify a single member of the mob. Isn't that interesting? Mississippi Governor Henry Whitefield promised an investigation, but nothing came of it, and a grand jury was convened, but of course, no one was arrested, tried, or convicted. LQ's mother, Allie, was so incredibly devastated that she died within a year of losing her son, and the Ivy family that was once thriving was forever broken. LQ Ivy was innocent, but in the eyes of the mob, his blackness was enough. His murder is painful and absolutely unimaginable. But it must be remembered. History cannot be ignored. For this next piece of Mississippi dark history, we go to Whitfield, Mississippi, where the Mississippi State Hospital is commonly referred to as Whitfield. It was opened in 1855. As I'm sure many of us know, mental illness was treated very differently during this time period. People who were mentally ill were referred to as lunatics or idiots. They were locked up in attics, stuffed into closets, and shunned from society. Families who had mental illness were embarrassed. Mental illness wasn't seen as an epidemic that needed to be dealt with through government resources and mental health care. It was simply ignored. By the early 19th century, this was finally starting to change. In January 1846, Governor Albert G. Brown proposed the Mississippi State Hospital, calling it a, quote, asylum for lunatics and a refuge for the insane. 2 years later, the legislature approved $10,000 and provided a five-acre lot in Jackson. The asylum was built following the Kirkbride Plan, making the space large, bright, and airy, promoting more moral treatment based on the idea that pleasant environment, outdoor work, social interaction, and cleanliness were more effective at curing mental illness than making the place look like a prison. The asylum's commissioners soon purchased a tract of 140 acres of land 2 miles north of Jackson. Dorothea L. Dix assisted in the project. She was a Boston school teacher and a mental health reformer, and the asylum opened its doors in 1855. Then to 1935, it's estimated about 35,000 were institutionalized here, with 10 to 11,000 patients dying on the premises. By 1856, a few slaves and black people who had been freed from slavery were admitted to Whitfield. Whitfield survived fires, tornadoes, and yellow fever epidemics, and it housed thousands of patients. In 1817, Governor James Alcorn would appoint Dr. William Compton as the superintendent of Whitfield. His goal was to modernize medical treatment for the mentally ill, and also to take in more patients. In fact, his goal was to double the facility's capacity. He also requested improved lodging for black people who lived there, saying that their conditions should be equal to the white patients. By 1900, Whitfield was deteriorating due to overcrowding. By 1926, there were over 2,000 patients and the grounds totaled more than 1,300 acres, which were farmed by the patients. In 1926, insane was dropped from the hospital's title and it became the Mississippi State Hospital. The hospital then opened at a new site in March 1935 with 350 acres and over 75 colonial-style red brick buildings. It had a capacity of 3,500 patients, and Whitfield remained racially segregated until the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Jaquith, a Vicksburg native who began his service to the hospital in 1947, transformed its approach to mental illness during his 3 decades of leadership. The patient population began to significantly decrease in the 60s. So now we flash forward to February 2000. The hospital museum opened, offering a concise historical overview of the treatment of mental illness in the state and the critical role of the Mississippi State Hospital. There is an original hydrotherapy room, needle spray or high-pressure showers, and a fever box or hot box that you can look at in the museum's exhibits. Antipsychotic meds weren't even a thing until the 50s, so these hospitals had to get really creative with their treatments. The idea with hydrotherapy rooms is that they were meant to replace restraints and calm agitated patients. They would use these baths to treat all kinds of things, insomnia, suicidal ideation, agitation, etc. The old asylum was demolished, and in 1954, the new University Medical Center was built, which still stands today. During this construction, many mass graves were found, and they were not always treated with respect. In 1990, 20 headstones were reportedly found and thrown into a gully. A few years after that, workers installing a laundry steam line would find 44 more unmarked graves. In 2013, during construction of a new road on the grounds of the University of Mississippi Medical Center, workers unearthed multiple mass graves containing deceased residents, making newspaper headlines. First, they found 66 bodies in very small pine boxes. There were no grave markers identifying the burials. Experts from state archives and the Mississippi State University Anthropology Department then removed the bodies and they documented the remains. They planned to later rebury them after examining them. The bodies were reburied at the UMMC cemetery. Soil testing was done on these locations that were slated to become a parking lot, and they found evidence of at least 1,000 bodies being buried at these grounds. These numbers only continued to climb. In 2018, archaeologists working in the area said that they were confident there were 3,000 bodies, but as many as 7,000. So these are all underneath the UMMC campus, and it seems that this entire campus is lying on top of an unmarked open mass grave. So it's no wonder there have been numerous accounts of paranormal activity. Unexplained sounds, apparitions, eerie sensations. These have been reported by staff members and students. Some individuals claim to hear footsteps and voices in areas near the oldest buildings, and this seems to amplify at night. Reported phenomenon often centers around the locations where the unmarked graves were found. Staff have sometimes reported seeing shadow figures, feeling sudden cold spots, or doors opening and shutting on their own. If you leave UMMC and go 48 miles east, you will hit the city of Vicksburg, Mississippi. Turn onto Harrison Street and you're going to find one of the most haunted houses in all of Mississippi. This is known as the McRaven. McRaven was built around 1797 by highwayman Andrew Glass. Mr. Glass, interestingly, was a criminal. He robbed people traveling to Natchez Trace. After a day of crime, he would return to the McRaven house with his loot and hide out. It's known that there are many spirits that linger to this day in McRaven, but it seems that this all began with Mr. Glass's unexpected death. After Mr. Glass died, there were the Howards. Sheriff Stephen Howard bought McRaven in 1836 and moved in with his 15-year-old wife, Mary, who was pregnant. But Mary did not survive childbirth and died in the home's middle bedroom. Mary's wedding shawl remains at McRaven on display, and visitors report seeing her apparition throughout the house. Mary also, being 15, seems to enjoy playing pranks on the visitors. The home was then sold to John H. Bob, who turned the home into a Confederate field hospital during the Civil War. The home endured cannon blasts and it housed wounded soldiers regularly. In fact, it's said that hundreds of soldiers are buried here in a mass grave just 50 feet from the house. And in 1864, Bob was shot and killed just 100 yards away from the home by Union troops. The next to move in was William Murray. Murray moved in with his family, and all four of them eventually would die in the home. Murray's two daughters, Ella and Annie, owned McRaven until 1960. By then, the house was dilapidated. It is said that the spirits of William Murray, Ella, and Annie never left McRaven. Today, the house is open to the public to tour. Many will report paranormal activity, and this includes the tour guides. One tour guide that was interviewed in a lot of the articles I read was a woman named Grace Bailey. Grace first started working at McRaven and was a skeptic at the time. but she recalled someone grabbing her ankle and brushing against her cheek. She has since turned into a believer of the paranormal, and she believes that this initial encounter was likely the work of the spirit of Mr. Glass, who is known to be fond of women who visit. Bailey initially shook off this encounter, but then when she had her second experience, she turned from a skeptic to a believer. So one day, Grace Bailey's working. She's checking the grounds as usual, making sure everything's in its proper place, and she's getting ready for the place to open for tours. Bailey noticed a man approaching the house. He walked along the brick pathway towards the front door. Bailey recalled that he seemed very overdressed. She prepared to greet the guest at the front door, but when she opened it, no one was there. She was obviously shaken up, and later when she was thinking about this apparition of this man that she saw, she thought about the significance of the date. It was July 4th, the day when Confederate forces surrendered to the Union Army in 1863. And it was exactly 1 year after this siege that John Bob was murdered. Bailey believes that the spirit she saw was Bob. On an evening in September 2025, skeptic and journalist Jim Baguez joined 13 other people on a McRaven ghost tour. During the tour, Baguez soon heard inexplicable footsteps. In this group of 13 was a man named John Williams. This was John's second time to visit McRaven, and he had actually driven 4 hours, claiming that the last time he visited McRaven, he had an unbelievable encounter. He saw the armoire in Mary Elizabeth Howard's room open and close on its own. He also brought his wife with him, Cassie, who experienced paranormal activity on their first visit as well. She said she felt someone or something touching her hair. Perhaps this was Mr. Glass, like what happened to Grace Bailey. So now John and Cassie are on this tour with skeptic and journalist Jim Baguez. And a few minutes past 11 p.m., the group stood in Mr. Glass's old bedroom. They got a string of responses through their spirit box, including a lot of obscenities. Another person in this group was a man named Brian Riley, who also works at McRaven. Riley has also had a handful of experiences while working here. He once saw a sheriff's baton move on its own in Mary Elizabeth's room. He's also claimed to see shadowy figures darting through the flowers outside. This was also around the time that his coworker, Grace Bailey, saw John Bob's ghost. But not all of the spirits here seem to be residual. Some seem violent. According to Riley, he's been knocked down and scratched once during a tour. When this happened, he then locked eyes with a strange ghostly woman with brown eyes and brown hair pulled back into a tight bun. She wore an 1830s-style brown dress with blue flowers. Riley saw her on the second floor balcony just outside Mary Elizabeth's room. The activity at McRaven increased even more after this encounter when one of the owners decided to do some digging outside. Never a good idea in a haunted location. But they were trying to do some construction, and during this digging, they accidentally found a human femur. Right when this happened, Riley was showing up to do a tour when he saw a shadowy figure step off of the porch and walk towards the back of the house. So, this is quite a group to have together for this ghost tour in September of 2025. We have all these people who have had all these experiences, and then we have this skeptic and journalist, Jim Baguez. But after this tour, Jim would say he left spooked. He would say in a CNN travel article, quote, "As my exhaustion broke the spell of curiosity, the narrative appealed to me. It was time to leave these ghosts to their revelry, if that's what it was, and retire from the hunt." In groups of 2 and 3, the other guests began to drop out and head to their cars, and I soon followed, careful, I must admit, to make sure nothing followed me on the way out. as I walked along the brick pathway, reversing the mysterious walk that made a believer out of Bailey, I tried to shake the thought that I was being watched. I emerged into the hazy light beaming down from a pair of utility poles, crossed the pavement of Harrison Street, which dead ends at McRaven, and made a brisk retreat to my vehicle, now sitting by itself at the far end of the gravel parking lot. Then, in one fluid motion, I locked the doors, cranked the engine, and threw the transmission into drive. End quote. So if you happen to be in Mississippi and you're looking for a spooky good time, it seems like the McRaven House is the location that needs to be at the top of your list. But be careful, it seems that not all of the spirits here are friendly. About 3 hours southeast of McRaven is a desolate road with one hell of an urban legend, pun intended. According to MississippiHauntedHouses.com, Waynesboro Shibata Road in Waynesboro, Mississippi is known for its paranormal activity. To locals, the road has been labeled Devil Worshipper Road, and most of the stories surrounding the road have naturally involved a satanic cult and sacrifice. Cars that drive along this road at night have reported their engines shutting off and an ominous feeling of being watched. Some have also claimed to see shadows around their vehicle, and something even violently shaking the car before leaving handprints behind. Part of the legend of Demon Worshipper Road is the legend of a local farmer who allegedly was a Satanist. In this legend, it is said the farmer sold his soul to the devil to gain power. But the devil tricked the farmer and transformed him into a hideous demonic creature, the Goatman. If you want to hear more about the legend of the infamous Goatman, I would recommend going back to the beginning of the podcast. I think it's episode 5. But the Goatman has been spotted all around the world, and Devil Worshipper Road is no different. Some who have dared drive down this road claim to see the Goatman. They say he stands at over 7 feet tall with white furry legs and a goat-like head with horns and glowing eyes. He is known to carry something in his hand. Some say it's a pitchfork, other people say it's a bloody axe. He has been known to suddenly appear in front of cars, then mysteriously vanish. On MississippiHauntedHouses.com, people can submit their experiences, and I found several about this road that caught my attention. The first one I read had unbelievably bad grammar, so I had to rewrite it quite a bit. Every word was capitalized, so I have rewritten this, but the idea of what happened hasn't changed. The story goes, one Friday night in 2018, this person went to pick up a girl from Ayla that they had been hooking up with. They hooked up, and then he dropped her back off and then went home. On his way home, it started raining really bad. The wind was howling, and he ended up on Devil's Road by mistake. The second that he got on the road, he claims his phone stopped working. He had GPS on, and this was malfunctioning, so he had no clue where he was going. And the rain was only getting worse and worse. Next, his dashboard started going haywire. His car was beeping, the dome lights were going on and off, and his headlights were flashing. So obviously at this point, he needs to pull over. He says when he pulled over, the doors of his car started slamming open and shut on their own. And then he felt a presence, like something was in his car with him. But then, all of a sudden, everything stopped. It was completely silent. The man's car started to work again and he drove home. The next day, he had to drive to work. So when he went to start his car, he realized the battery was completely dead. This was a brand new battery that he apparently had just put in his car. And 2 years after this encounter is when he found out about the legend of Devil Worshipper Road. Other people who rode into Mississippi Haunted Houses claimed to feel a strange presence in their vehicle while driving here. Some of them said they got really dizzy and disoriented. And some of them also said they found ghost handprints on their car or stumbled across proof of satanic rituals like pentagrams and dead animals. One man even claimed to have encountered the Goat Man. He says, quote, "Back in 2015, me, my brother, and a friend went fishing at the Devil's Pond on Devil Worshipper Road. I ended up leaving them there to go to work. Well, at 2 a.m., I get a call from my brother telling me to go back to the pond and get the fishing equipment for them because they left them there to walk home. At this point, it was 2:40 a.m., and as I was grabbing the poles and the cooler, I heard a twig break. I slowly turned my flashlight on and I turned around. There stood a 7-foot-tall goat man staring at me with red, beady eyes. I quickly grabbed everything and I ran to my car as fast as I could. I threw everything in without even shutting the trunk and hauled ass. When I got home, I told them never again will I be going there. When I told them what happened, they just laughed and said they didn't believe me. But I know what I saw and he was real." End quote. So let's just say if you happen to end up in Waynesboro, Mississippi, make sure you stay on the main roads and avoid Waynesboro Shubata Road, aka Devil Worshipper Road. A couple hours east of Devil Worshipper Road is another Mississippi city full of dark history and haunted locations, Natchez. The Eola Hotel sits in downtown and it seems to be the home of several restless spirits. The hotel was named after the daughter of the original owner, and it opened its doors in 1927. The hotel was super popular until the 80s, and then it started struggling financially. People weren't staying here as much because the hotel wasn't as nice and new, and so it permanently closed in the 2010s. With any grand old southern hotel comes a trove of ghost stories, and the Eola is no exception. Over the decades, there have been countless witnesses that have come forward claiming to have experienced things like flickering lights, disembodied voices, and even a mysterious lady in white while they were staying here. Witnesses describe her as an apparition dressed in 1920s-style clothing. She's often seen gracefully descending the grand staircase or gliding through the ballroom. Some people say this woman was a bride who tragically died on her wedding day. We hear this with a lot of Lady in White stories. Other people believe she was some type of beloved hotel guest who passed away in one of the suites. Guests have reported feeling sudden chills if she's near, or feeling an inexplicable presence watching them from afar. One former staff member even claimed to see the Lady in White staring at her from the top floor window after the hotel had been locked up for the night. The hotel's elevators are also known to malfunction, operating on their own. And these issues were actually documented by maintenance crews. When they were trying to do remodeling in the 80s and 90s, it seems that the ghosts weren't too happy about this. Maintenance workers kept documenting inexplicable elevator malfunctions, and this would happen over and over. Ghost hunting teams have investigated the hotel when it was still open, and they reported that this was a hotspot for EMF anomalies. EVPs have also been captured near the elevator shaft. Paranormal experts have suggested the elevator may serve as some kind of energetic conduit for residual hauntings. It is said that in the Eola, the most haunted room was 323. Former guests and employees reported sudden temperature drops, furniture moving on its own, and hearing intense whispers during the night. A local legend suggests that this room was once the site of a violent altercation in the 40s. A wealthy businessman was caught by his wife with his mistress. The Eola has been closed for public stays, but there are still sometimes local paranormal tours. So the building still stands. Another haunted location in Natchez is King's Tavern. King's Tavern is said to be the most haunted restaurant in all of Mississippi. It's haunted by several ghosts, including a lady named Madeline, one of the original owners. Some say she was murdered by her lover's wife. The most shocking part of the lore of King's Tavern is the discovery in the 1930s. Three mummified bodies were discovered in the cellar, hidden in the wall behind the fireplace. It's believed one of these bodies was Madeline. A jeweled dagger believed to be the murder weapon was also found with the remains. Who was responsible remains a mystery. But people who have visited the tavern have reported hearing the sound of a baby crying, seeing strange reflections in the mirrors, and the empty beds being disturbed and feeling warm to the touch, as if someone had been sleeping in them. Next, we will head into the northeastern area of Mississippi, where you can visit the Waverly Mansion in Clay County. This is 10 miles east of West Point, and this home was formerly a plantation house. It is now a historic museum, and it was built in 1838, originally owned by George Hampton Young, a colonel from Georgia. Young named the home after Sir Walter Scott's novel, Waverly. It was originally built for his wife Lucy and their 10 kids. There are said to be a number of different ghosts haunting Waverly Mansion, but the most famous one is the apparition of a small girl, searching and calling out for her mother. In 1962, Robert and Donna Snow bought Waverly and claimed that they encountered the spirit of this little girl soon after. Their daughter Cindy also claimed to see her. She was regularly sighted on the grand staircase. This little girl is also known to take naps in one of the upstairs bedrooms, leaving behind an indention in the bed. The Snows many times would straighten up the sheets, only to find them messed up again. It's generally believed this little girl may have been the child of one of the neighbors during the Civil War period. She was ill and brought to Waverly to be cared for by the servants. It's believed she passed away in the home. In addition to the spirit of this little girl, several other ghosts are said to haunt Waverly, including a Confederate soldier. His face often appears in the mirrors behind visitors. The parlor of the home has also been known for phantom music and disembodied laughter. And the grounds of Waverly are also known for a ghost rider on a horse, who's been spotted in the yard on several occasions. In southern Mississippi, near the Pascagoula incident, lies a private and allegedly haunted cemetery. Formerly the Garden of Hope Cemetery, the Franklin Cemetery has quite a story to tell. According to one legend, there's a man named Hal who worked at Ingalls Shipbuilding in the late 70s. He had a wife and five kids. One day, the kids and his wife met up with Hal at a motel in Gautier. It was a special day because they were going to take Hal's work bonus check and put a down payment on a house that they had been dreaming about getting. But Hal didn't get the bonus that he was expecting. Instead, he was laid off. Hal was so distraught that he lost his mind, murdering his wife and five children with an axe as they slept in the motel room. Then Hal walked into traffic, swinging his axe wildly. He was struck and killed by a truck. In the years since, the legend claims that visitors to this Garden of Hope Cemetery have seen the spirit of Hal and his five children. The five children are known to play among the gravestones. One of these children is Cheryl Ann. She's known to be a young and friendly spirit. Hal, not so much. He's been spotted coming out of his grave, stealing flowers from the other graves, and then returning back to his. Then there is the spirit of Bloody Sarah. She's known to run into the road with her blood-stained robe and fuzzy slippers, making motorists think that they have run someone over. Bloody Sarah seems to think this is pretty funny because she's known to laugh maniacally throughout the entire encounter. Passerbys have also reported seeing a gravedigger hitchhiking along the road, but when they stop, he informs them that he's dead. Then he disappears. To finish up today's Haunted Mississippi episode, our last stop is Chautauqua, a tiny southwestern Mississippi community, first settled in 1817. This place is quite literally a blip on a map but it sets the backdrop for one of the most famous cryptids in all of Mississippi. The legend claims that several decades ago, there was a circus train rolling into the area. It was headed for New Orleans, and the train boasted many strange creatures, including the Ape Man. The Ape Man was basically like a Bigfoot, and he was said to be very angry and aggressive, so he was kept in his own private train car with heavy iron bars. But this train rolls in, and it derailed near the Changipahoa Swamp. One of the animals perished, with the only survivors being a few monkeys and the Ape Man, who managed to escape from his cage. A couple weeks later, the story began to circulate throughout the area, and there were people saying that the monkeys and the Ape Man were being sighted near the swampland. It's also possible the nearby Kramer Lodge gave rise to this urban legend. It was reported that an animal sanctuary was here that had monkeys and apes. St. Mary's School near Osiaka also popularized the legend because upperclassmen would scare the freshmen with stories about the Ape Man lurking in the woods. Even the nuns who taught at the school claimed to have seen monkeys in the woods. In September 1985, the Enterprise Journal posted an article about the Ape Man, calling it the Chautauqua Monster. The article stated Sister Patricia Powers believed some kids that she went to school with may have made up the legend. Another local who was interviewed by the paper at the time claimed to have participated in bringing the monster back to life in the 80s. He told reporters how he stretched cowhide across a hollow log to scare locals. A third local reported that he actually was stalked in the woods by the monster, though, so who knows, maybe Chautauqua, Mississippi has its very own Bigfoot. So that, everybody, is some perplexing and dark history and urban legends from Mississippi. Thank you, Amanda, for requesting this topic. I hope you guys enjoyed today's episode. If you did, be sure to let me know. If you're watching on YouTube, like this video and subscribe. Drop a comment down below. Which story was your favorite? Have you ever been to any of these places? Do you have a haunting experience from Mississippi? If you're listening on Spotify, you can also comment on this episode, letting me know your thoughts. Thank you all so much for listening. You all are amazing. I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe, and I will talk to you next week. Bye. Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast, is hosted, written, and produced by me, Kadra Brannon. This show is proud to be a part of the Black Cat Network. Assistant editor is Charlie Leopold. Assistant producer is TJ McRae. Theme song by Patrick Thompson. Music for this episode is from Pixabay. If you enjoyed today's episode, leave a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. If you have a story to share or a topic request, email perplexitymysterypodcast@gmail.com. Contact, support, and merch links can be found in the episode description. And you can always unlock early and ad-free episodes and exclusive bonus content by joining the Perplexed Society at patreon.com/perplexitymysterypodcast. Until next week, stay curious.